This week we move from the event of Matan Torah to the mitzvahs of Mishpatim, and the discussion in Parshas Mishpatim begins with the very first pasuk, Ve'eile ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem, Perek Kaf Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. And there's room to raise a simple question. Ve'eile ha-mishpatim introduces mishpatim. Asher tasim lifnehem seems somewhat redundant. I mean, these are the mishpatim, they're for the Jewish people, or for the dayanim, or for whoever they are. If the pasuk had said ve'eile ha-mishpatim, these are the mishpatim. What is added or accentuated with the words asher tasim lifnehem, seemingly obvious? These are the mishpatim, they should be put before them, whoever they are. And there's many answers to this question from the Mefarshim, but a particularly interesting approach is found in the name of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Vilna, who became then known as Rabbi Jacob Joseph, in New York, the much discussed and ill-fated chief rabbinate of New York, did not have much nachas there at all, to put it mildly. But in Vilna, he was a magid, and he gave droshas. Rav Chaim Zagorodzhensky would come to his droshas, and as would many other gedolim. And there's many wonderful divrei Torah from him. And he explains as follows. What is the goal of the dayan? What is the goal of the judge? The simple answer, of course, is to mete out justice and to give the perpetrator what he deserves within the framework of mishpat. However, says Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, if you survey the mishpatim of the Torah, the punitive measures of the Torah, we will see very soon that they're equal, they're level, in the sense that the same punishment is given for the crime, regardless of the background to the crime or the circumstances of the crime. And if that sounds somewhat abstract, let's give a couple of examples. If one would injure his fellow, so as we know, eighth parak of Bava Kamma, there are the payments to be made, the restitution for damage, and if relevant, for medical fees and distress and so on. What we don't take into account are the differing circumstances of the act itself. For example, one person may, in the heat of the moment, in a moment of anger, lash out at someone else. Someone else may injure their fellow in a much more callous or cruel or premeditated way. And that doesn't feature. You would never find the Beis Din saying that because this was done in a more calculated way, which displays more cruelty, therefore you need to pay him more. It purely addresses the act at hand, the act itself, not what goes into it. A second example, if a person would steal from someone else, there are set punishments in terms of financial restitution, the amount itself, of the value of the object, if it's Geneva, perhaps Kefel, and the famous ox and the sheep, four or five. But these payments are uniform. They would not take into account, again, additional surrounding circumstances. For example, is there no difference at all whether it was someone who was, let's say, poor, who stole from someone rich, poor and hungry, who stole from someone rich? It's not permitted. But is that to be dealt with in the same way as, for example, someone who's rich who stole from someone poor? We get the feeling that it's a different type of act. And yet, the halacha does not distinguish between them. And that's important to recognize and raise the question, why is that? Why would we not see a difference also in terms of punishment between these two situations? One which has much more callousness and cruelty and hardness of heart. And the answer, says Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, is that there is no question that ultimately these two deeds are not the same. They do not share the same quality. They don't have the same fabric. However, it is impossible for a human being to meaningfully calculate and assess these factors, these elements. How does one put a price to cruelty or impetuousness or callousness and so on? It cannot be done. And that is why the Dayanim are warned away from getting involved in those things. The punishment that the Dayan gives, one could say, is the lowest common denominator, as if to say what everyone who would do an act like this would be obligated in, would be liable for. What about the additional factors? It's something that a human being, a human court, cannot assess. But what's very interesting is, a human court cannot assess this, but a heavenly court can. It's very illustrative and illuminating in this regard to refer to the case of David and Bathsheba, which is in Shmuel Beis, in Perek Yud Beis, and as we know, David, he took Bathsheba from her husband Uriah and arranged for Uriah to meet his end. And there was a whole episode there. We're not going to attempt to explain its complexities, but David was not spared retribution there. And it came in the form of a mashal, the well-known mashal that was brought to him by Nosson Hanavi. And the parable was, in order for David to get a clear picture of himself, that you had a rich man and a poor man, and the rich man had a massive amount of sheep, and the poor man just had this one sheep. That was it. And there came a time when the rich man wanted to make a party, and he didn't want to use any of his sheep, and he stole that one sheep from the poor man. And shechted it and used it for his feast. Says Nosson Hanavi to David, what do you think about that? What would you say? And the Pasuk says, this is in again Shmuel Beis, Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Hei Vayichar Af David Ba'ishmaod. David was very angry at this person in the story. Vayomer al Nosson, he said to Nosson, Chai Hashem, by Hashem's life, ki ben maves ha'ish ha'oseh zos. That person is liable to be killed. Which, of course, is not what we recognize as a halachic response to that act at all. The act at the end of the day was one of theft. He stole a sheep. So the most one could say is to pay back fourfold, as we know. And David didn't say that. David said he should be killed. Where does that come from? But what's more interesting is that David goes on in the next pasuk to say, Vesakivsoi shalem abatayim. And then you should pay fourfold for the sheep, which is what we recognize as the verdict. But where does the first verdict come from? And moreover, since when does a person ever get two verdicts? We are familiar with the idea, komle b'derabe mine, if a person would be killed, he doesn't pay. And David says he should be killed, and he has to pay for the sheep. But what we see here, and of course at that stage, Nosson, the Navi, says to him, that's you, you're the rich man. Uri was the poor man. You have your wives, he just had Bathsheba, and you took her from him, and David recognized that through the parable. He was brought face to face unavoidably with whatever it is that he had done, and that thus embarked his path of tshuva there, the famous kashan, Nosson el David. But in terms of his reactions, says Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, I mean, here you see David responding to the totality of the situation. Because there's really two aspects here. there's the theft aspect, and there's the cruelty aspect. You have so much, and he had this just one thing. David doesn't say that he should be killed, but he says he's been malvis, meaning this person is deserving of death. I'm not saying that one should kill him, but that really represents a response to these broader elements of the case, the moral issue, and such like. He then goes on to pronounce the actual halachic verdict, which is to pay fourfold for the sheep. But and that's all the Bezdin will do, because they can't really take care of anything else. But you see here David's twofold reaction to the two elements of the crime, as David himself concludes. Ekev asher asa asa davar hazeh, because he did this thing, ve'al asher lo chamal. Those are two causes. Number one, the act, asher asa asa davar hazeh, and number two, where is his compassion? This is so antithetical to the compassion a person should have. That's what's behind the two verdicts. Fourfold because he did it, and ben maves because where is his compassion? And we all understand that Bezdin Shel Mata can only address the things that can be quantified and concretized. Everything else they have to leave. But who do they leave it for? They leave it for Hashem. But that leads us to a fascinating conclusion. Namely, it could be that a person wronged his fellow in a way that had so many other elements beyond what the Bezdin will address. The implications of what Rabbi Yaakov Yosef is saying is that his case will not be closed fully when the Bezdin administer their punishment, because they're only addressing certain parts of it. But the rest is still an open case. If the Bezdin don't take care of it, Hashem will. It gives a very interesting twist, I would say, to when we say, Elokim nitzav ba'adas keil. Hashem also is there in a din Torah. We normally understand he's there to help the Dayanim reach their conclusion. But it could be that one of the reasons why Hashem is there in the Bezdin is because he's also judging this person. And therefore the Bezdin, when they take care of their part, Hashem will then take care of his part. Maybe a person shouldn't leave the Bezdin and say, I paid my fourfold, I will never hear from this again. He may yet need to make emotional restitution with the person for additional aspects of the wrongdoing, if there are. And this, I think, could give us additional insight into a statement of the Michilta, which notes the juxtaposition of Mishpatim to last week's parsha, which is the Aseres HaDibros. Famously, Mishpatim begins with a Vav, even though it's seemingly a new topic. A new topic should start just with Eile. The Eile seems to connect it. But what's the connection? Says the Medrash, they are connected. Ma'elu mi-Sinai, just like the earlier were from Sinai, Av'elu mi-Sinai, Ma'rishonu mi-Sinai, Av'elu mi-Sinai. They're all from Sinai, and that means many things. Of course, the whole Torah is from Sinai. But what we mean is, in the same way that when we stood at Har Sinai, we understood that Hashem is basically in control of everything, that consciousness needs to pervade also the Bezdin. Just like at Har Sinai, it was clear to you that Hashem is controlling everything and will take care of, ultimately, of everything. So too, when the Bezdin sits down to Mishpat, it's with a Sinai consciousness. Because there's no way that you can deal with only part of the crime, which is really what Bezdin do, unless you're confident that Hashem will deal with the rest. I think there's room to say that Lahavdil, in a secular court, they do try and take care of these other things. They do try and quantify somehow for anguish and for so on and so forth, taking the whole situation into account. They try and address all of that. And perhaps one of the reasons why is because there is an underlying feeling of someone has to take care of this. Someone has to deal with those elements. And if we don't, who will? And if it's a secular court, that's a rhetorical question. The answer is no one. So we have to take care of everything. And we don't, and you can't say, well, there's no way to quantify it because there is no other alternative. But a Torah court says, no, there is another alternative. There's someone, capital S, who is well capable of taking care of all of these other things. We'll take care of what we need to. And coming back to the opening pasuk, therefore, this is how Rabbi Yaakov Yosef reads the pasuk, Ve'eila ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem. The words asher tasim lifneihem are not obvious and they're not redundant. They are qualifying Parshas Mishpatim. If it said Ve'eila ha-mishpatim and that's it, so then the notion may have been, or the understanding is that this is the totality of Mishpatim, but it isn't. Ve'eila ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem means these are the elements of Mishpat that you put before them, implying there are other elements of Mishpat that you do not put before them. That's correct. Elokim nitzav ba'adas keil. Hashem says, this I've entrusted to you, certain elements of the case, the rest leave to me. So very, very profound understanding of the Torah's own introduction to Mishpatim. What's for the Beis Din and what's not for them. And it really is now a partnership. Justice ultimately is a partnership between the Dayanim and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, each one taking care of what they are able to take care of. For the Beis Din, whose capabilities are limited, and the rest leaving for Hashem's capabilities are unlimited. So this is his comment on the opening pasuk, Ve'eila mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem. Now, as we know, the first mishpat is Eved Ivri, and that itself is a major discussion. Why does mishpatim open with Eved Ivri? What is behind that choice? Especially as, if he is an Eved Ivri, if he has been sold, it must be because he stole and couldn't pay back, which is actually a law that is presented later on in Parshas Mishpatim. So we really seem to have reached into the middle of the Parsha, pulled out a segment of the story, and that opens Parshas Mishpatim, and there's many explanations as to why that is. We ourselves have discussed it in the past, but I would like to get to a well-known halacha within Eved Ivri, and that is expressed in Pasuk He and Pasuk Vav. So let us see there, still in Perek Kaf Aleph, Pasuk He and Pasuk Vav. We know that the Eved Ivri stays for 6 years, and then he goes out in the seventh year. However, says Pasuk He, Ve'im amar yomar ha'eved, but what if he will say, Ahav yes Aduni, I love my master, es ishti ves banai, my wife and my children, who you may have had while in servitude, lo etze chafshi, and he doesn't want to go free. He's able to go free, but he doesn't want it. So then what? So we have the famous piercing of the ear, v'higisho adonav elo Elohim, they bring him to the Beis Din. This is one of the times a judge is called Elohim, three times in the Parsha. That's one of the sources for a Beis Din being of three Dayonim, v'higisho al adeles o al hamezuzah. They take him to the doorpost. V'ratza adonav esozno bamartzea, and the master pierces his ear with an awl. Va'avado le'olam, and he will serve now his master le'olam. Now, the question is, what does le'olam mean? How long is le'olam? It sounds permanently. We translate le'olam as forever. And therefore, the simple meaning of the pasuk would seem to be that if he doesn't go out after 6 years, he is the Eved permanently until the day he dies. It could be another 40, 50, 60, 70 years. But as we know, that's not the halacha. The halacha is that if he elects to stay past the 6 years, he stays until the Yovel, but no longer. And this is mentioned by Rashi. Va'avado le'olam, quoting the words of the pasuk, again, which sounds like he stays there forever. Ad ha-Yovel, until the Yovel. Says Rashi, how do I know this? O eino ela le'olam kamashma'o. Maybe it really means le'olam, he never goes free. Talmud Lomar, so Rashi cites, and of course Rashi is coming from Medrash Chazal, V'isha mishpachto tashuvu. In Parshas Behar, which deals with the Yovel, it says that in the Yovel year, everyone goes back to their families, referring to Avadim. So now we know that he goes free in the Yovel, which means that Va'avado Le'olam means until the Yovel. So this is a very interesting situation, because we have the Pasuk, and the simple reading of the Pasuk sounds like he stays forever. But then we have this other idea, which is based on a Pasuk elsewhere, that in the Yovel, everyone goes back, including him. And that now causes us to reconsider our understanding of Le'olam. We no longer look at Le'olam in the straightforward way, the simple way that it means forever, but rather it means till the Yovel. The question is, how can Le'olam mean until the Yovel? As if to say, Yovel is a certain time. Le'olam sounds like it means forever. Now, you can say that he stays till the Yovel. That may well be, and that's the truth. That's the halacha. But then what does the Pasuk mean by saying that he stays Le'olam? Why would the Pasuk say something and then, so to speak, unsay it? Because is it possible to understand that Le'olam means until the Yovel? That we're being forced to reframe our definition of Le'olam? It's possible that it does. It's certainly not the simple meaning. Le'olam simply means permanently, forever. But based on this additional pasuk, we look differently at the word Le'olam. Because Le'olam means for the rest of that world. Olam is a world. As long as the world is there, so then this pertains. But how long is the world there for? This brings us to the Yovel year. We know that there are certain halachas that pertain to the Yovel year, specifically, in addition to the Shemitah type halachas. Things are reversed. Slaves go free. Land that was sold reverts back. And those are the special halachas. When you sell land, you sell it until Yovel year. And the Yovel, everything goes back. The question is, why does everything go back? And we might be inclined to say, because the Torah says it goes back. And that's as simple as that. But it happens to be that the Torah itself provides reasons why slaves go back, why land goes back. The Torah says, you know why a slave will go back at the Yovel year? Because ultimately, the entire Jewish people are my servants. And therefore, servants can't have servants. You know why land goes back in the Yovel year, says Hashem? Because the land is really mine. So it's not really yours to sell. What's fascinating about the special mitzvahs of the Yovel year is that they're not only, quote unquote, commandments that are given. They're given with a vision. A new vision of how to look at the Jewish people, how they should look at themselves, and how they should look at the land of Israel. As if to say, things that are always true at a core level, it comes to the fore in Yovel. For the balance of the 49 years, we are allowed to proceed as if the land is ours. And you can sell it, and you can sell it for however long you want, within that frame. For the balance of those 49 years, you can keep a servant because you can own him and have that perspective. When Yovel comes, you don't look at things in the same way anymore. You don't look at him as your servant anymore. He goes free naturally because how can you have him as a servant if you're all Hashem's servants? The land reverts naturally to its original owner because it's not his to sell anymore. So these halachas, they're the product of a different vision. And it could be that this vision, which only really comes to the fore once every 50 years, it's literally a different world. That is why we say, and that's what part of what the Torah is communicating. When it wants to say that he stays until the Yovel, it says he stays Le'olam. Le'olam means as long as that world exists. And that's true. It only exists until the Yovel, because the entire world looks different during the Yovel year. Definitions of things and identities and ownerships and all of those things are completely recalibrated. It really is a new Olam, and therefore the Olam that he was a servant until expires. So this is perhaps a way to understand how, once we discover halachically that the Eved only stays till the Yovel year, it's still called Le'olam. Yovel is a new world. It's worth noting, before moving to another approach more from the Acharonim, that we have made an assumption, and Rashi has made that assumption, and us together with him, that the simple meaning of the word Le'olam is permanently. Le'olam means permanently. But the Ibn Ezra, on this pasuk, is not convinced that that is the case. He cites the idea, the halacha, that it is until the Yovel, he stays, and he says that's what Le'olam means. Le'olam, says Ibn Ezra, does not mean forever. It means for a long while. Now, why do I say that? On what basis do I say that? He cites a pasuk in Koheles. And in Koheles it says, it's one of the times where he says there's something that people think is very new, but it's not new. It's been around for a while. Yesh davar, that people say it's chadash, kvar haya le'olamim. But it's already been around. For how long? Le'olamim. Le'olamim is the plural of le'olam. Says Ibn Ezra, there is no plural of forever. Because forever is the whole time. You cannot have forevers, because they're all included in the first forever. And therefore, if le'olam means always, there can be no plural. It's just le'olam. What is le'olamim? That is why I say, says Ibn Ezra, that le'olam means a long time. Not forever. And if it means a long time, which has yet to be defined how long, but if it means a finite long time, so there's room for the word le'olamim. Many a long time. Which is even longer than le'olam. And it's very interesting that we will use terms like, sometimes we'll say le'olam, but sometimes we'll say le'olam va'ed. What does the word va'ed add? In English, we perhaps cheat a little bit, because if le'olam we say means forever, so the le'olam va'ed means forever and ever. But when is the ever after forever? We don't think about it. It's just a convenient way to translate the words. But it could be, according to the Ibn Ezra, that if le'olam means for a long time, but it doesn't mean permanently, you need a word like va'ed, until ongoing. And therefore, says Ibn Ezra, if it is so, that le'olam really means for a long time, so then it's just a matter of defining how long. And enter the other pasuk, until the Yovel. That's how long. It's still a long time, but it's not forever. And that's the simple meaning of the word le'olam, for a long time, until the Yovel. So this is a very interesting, one could say, implicit machlokas between Rashi and Ibn Ezra. Rashi does seem to see the word le'olam as forever, unless further stated. Permanently. But for Ibn Ezra, from the outset, it never means more than a long time, in this instance, till the Yovel. It's very interesting. The Ibn Ezra is combining the world of Pshat to explain the Halacha, and it's actually a perfect fit, because Le'olam means a long time, namely, in this instance, the Yovel. But just to complete our collection of perspectives on this Va'avado Le'olam and how it relates to the Yovel, there is a comment of the Vilna Gaon in his Perush Aderes Eliyahu on the Torah. It's one line and it can change everything. So again, Pasuk says if he wants to stay on, he does, and he stays on Le'olam. We know that he goes free in Yovel. How do you square that with the Pasuk Va'avado Le'olam? Says the Vilna Gaon, Va'avodo le'olam, if he stays on forever. Kipshuto, as it seems, he stays on forever. Now, the Vilna Gaon is well aware that he actually leaves at the Yovel. But the first things first, Kipshuta means he stays there permanently. Kipshuta, at Olmead, he literally, till the end of his days. Ach, Hayovel Yotzio, but Yovel can set him free. That's the Vilna Gaon. And what has he said? He's saying that our understanding of how this Eved works, he does go free at the Yovel. Don't think that what that means is, from the outset, he's only indentured for a further duration until the Yovel comes. It's not in advance only for that time. From the outset, he is a permanent Eved. But something can happen called the Yovel. If the Yovel happens, the Yovel will set him free. The Yovel revokes his sentence of Le'olam. It doesn't define the sentence from the outset as being just to the Yovel. Le'olam means always, permanently, forever. Yovel revokes it. And this is picked up by the Meshech Chochma. Interestingly, he does not quote the Vilna Gaon. Maybe I didn't have access to the Sefer Deres Eliyahu. And he independently propounds this idea that initially, in principle, he's an Eved for life. Yovel can emancipate him. That's who cross him to roar. It can free him from his life of servitude. And should you say, says Meshech Chochma, well, at the end of the day, it sounds like two ways of saying the same thing. Tachlis, as they like to say in Hebrew, he goes free of the Yovel. Does it make a difference whether from the outset he's only an Eved to the Yovel, or he's an Eved permanently and then the Yovel sets him free? At the end of the day, he goes free. Says Meshech Chochma, yes, it could make a difference. There could be a halachic implication for what we're saying. We know at a certain point, the Yovel stopped. The Yovel is when all the Jewish people are there, all the tribes are there. As soon as the first two tribes, even from the east side of the Yarden, went into exile, the Yovel stopped. And it didn't stop in a Yovel year. It stopped halfway through and just the Yovel dissolved. Says Meshech Chochma, what would be the status, the halachic status of someone, we might think he's a shlemazel, he chose the wrong Yovel to do this, but someone who had elected to stay on, and then there was no Yovel waiting for him on the other side. Says Meshech Chochma, he will stay an Eved, he would have stayed an Eved for the rest of his life. Because va'avadu le'olam means it really is permanent. Yovel can set you free. But there was no Yovel. But by the time it was meant to come, if that was the Yovel that was discontinued. It is no different, says Meshech Chochma, from if a person had sold a field, and again, a field would go back. He cites a Tosus in Maseches Arachin, that if a person sold a field during that time, and then the Yovel is discontinued, he won't get his field back. It's a permanent sale. Yovel reverses it. In the absence of the reverse force, the initial sale remains for all time. So these are fascinating different ways to look at this. We don't need to get to ayin tachas ayin, which is money, before we start asking how do we understand what seems to be the pshat of the pasuk in terms of what we know to be the halacha. Discussions of this sort begin already in the opening psukim with the word va'avadu le'olam. How does that work together with Yovel? We saw Rashi, we saw Ibn Ezra, and we saw the Vilna Gaon as elaborated upon by Meshech Chochma. Certainly much to think about in terms of the role really of Pshuto Shel Mikra as it meets the world of halacha. Well, Mishpatim, we know, is in the province of the Beis Din. As we mentioned before, the smallest Beis Din is three. For a normal case of a monetary case, three dayanim are really enough. Most Beis Dins that we would be familiar with nowadays are have a panel of three, and it allows you a majority of 2-1. There are some Beis Dins which are larger for capital cases, for example. It has to be a Sanhedrin already. Sanhedrin is 23. the Gemara darshans out the relevant numbers, and the 23 is what's called Sanhedria Ketana, a smaller Sanhedrin. And then, of course, the ultimate supreme Sanhedrin, Sanhedria Gedola, is the 71, and that's in Yerushalayim. These are the three iterations of Beis Din. 3 for normal cases, 23 for even capital cases, and then 71 as the supreme Sanhedria Gedola in Yerushalayim. And we're not familiar with, the halacha does not really recognize any other configurations of Dayanim. Those are the three, that's what you'll find in looking at Masechah Sanhedrin, as each one is explained how we get those numbers. But as we know, that's not entirely the case. Because one of the most famous Sanhedrins in history did not have any of those numbers. And we refer, of course, to the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. The Anshei Knesset HaGedola, famous in Pirkei Avos, they're the first to speak there, they were a Sanhedrin. Yet as we know, they numbered 120 members. And it's very interesting to ponder, where did that number come from? Since when do we recognize or are familiar with a Sanhedrin of 120 members? 71 is as big as it gets. We're so familiar with the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, and we know there's 120 of them. It's very easy never to wonder why. Just to add to the puzzle, there is a Yerushalmi in Maseches Megillah. The festival of Purim itself, at a certain stage, was ratified. It was ratified by the Sanhedrin. I mean, Megillas Esther was written by Mordechai and Esther, but they're not a Sanhedrin. They cannot mandate it as halacha. It became a halachic fixture in the calendar, only by a Sanhedrin. And the Yerushalmi says in Megillah, it was enacted by a Sanhedrin of 88 members. And now I think we've heard everything. 120, 88, every number other than the numbers that we're used to. And this matter is discussed in a wonderful volume written by Rav Reuven Margolius Zatzal, who wrote many, many Svarim. And the Sefer is called Yesod HaMishnah V'Arichosa. It can't be more than 60 or 70 pages, but it's a slim volume. It contains volumes. Everything he says could be expanded. And it's many, many references and sources, etc. He wrote very, very compactly, but extremely clearly. And Rav Reuven Margolius suggests as follows. If we wish to understand what is behind the mystery of a Sanhedrin having 120 members, it is as follows. The original Sanhedrin of 71 members was set up under the auspices of Moshe Rabbeinu himself. In Parshas Baal Osecha, Esfoli Shivim Ish. You had the original 70 and with Moshe 71. Now, the question is, not all of them, not the members of the Sanhedrin, will live permanently. At a certain point, they would retire or pass away and would need to be replaced. How is that to be done? Well, there was a whole system, as we know from Sanhedrin itself. There were people who were judges in training, or judges in waiting. And who would determine who is, if a vacancy made itself available, who would determine who's able to come in? The existing Dayanim. And they would decide however they decide. But for every space that's available, you have 70 Dayanim to decide who should take that space. And thus you had this dynamic equilibrium of 71 Dayanim, which was able to be maintained. And there was never a shaila as to who should be on the Sanhedrin, because on a case-by-case basis, it was the existing members who then brought in the next Dayan. As we know, however, the Sanhedrin was dissolved with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Everyone went into exile. There's no Sanhedrin anymore. And that lasted for 70 years. And now there's an interesting question. In the Second Commonwealth, as we're about to inaugurate the era of the second Beis HaMikdash, and the Sanhedrin needs to get back on track. Who will be part of that Sanhedrin? And who will decide who's part of that Sanhedrin? For the first time since the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, you can't say let the existing members of the Sanhedrin vote in new members. There is no Sanhedrin. And therefore, Rav Margolyas suggests they surveyed those that were potentially eligible, and there were more than 70 of them, but who's to say who's in and who's out? And for this reason, the original Sanhedrin had more than 70 members in it. No one should say so-and-so should have been on the Sanhedrin, and who's to say that he shouldn't? 120 were considered to be eligible, and the Sanhedrin therefore comprised 120. That's what's behind this unique body called the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. However, we can appreciate, says Rav Margolyas, that 120 is not a real number for a Sanhedrin. It's not a natural number for a Sanhedrin or Gedolah. It was the contingency number. But what if a vacancy? What if one of the members, again, retired or passed away? So when it goes down to 119, they didn't fill that vacancy because it's not meant to be 120. And thus it was that the Sanhedrin progressively lessened until it reached its final true number, which is 71. This is why, says Rav Margolyas, the Yerushalmi can say that the festival of Purim was ratified by a Beis Din, a Sanhedrin of 88. It's not that they convened a Sanhedrin of 88. 88 is not a number for Sanhedrin at all. But what it means is it was at the process of the diminishing in numbers from 120 down to 71, Purim was ratified at the frame where they stood at 88. That's how it explains the Yerushalmi. And as a final stroke here, says Rav Margolyas, it could be that the Sanhedrin, as it was brought down to 71, was called after the original Knesset HaGedolah, was called the Shiori Knesset HaGedolah. We know that Shimon HaTzadik, also in Pirkei Avos, this is Perek Aleph Mishnah Beis, Shimon HaTzadik Hayom is Shiori Knesset HaGedolah. And many question, in terms of the chronology, when Shimon HaTzadik lived, if we understand on a straightforward level, translate, he was one of the survivors of the Knesset HaGedolah. That would place him at being extremely old, 100 plus or more, to say that he was one of the survivors of the Knesset HaGedolah. But that is why Rav Margolyas suggests that the Sanhedrin that remained after it had been whittled down to 71, that Sanhedrin was called the remnant of the Knesset HaGedolah, Mishiori Knesset HaGedolah. He was a member of that Sanhedrin, albeit many decades later. So these are very, very interesting answers to equally interesting questions. Where does 120 come from? Where does 88 come from? How long does Shimon HaTzadik live? What does Shiori Knesset HaGedolah mean? These are very interesting mishpatim questions that he deals with, among so many other things, in that Sefer, Yesod HaMishnah V'Ari Chasa. It's a Sefer that was recommended to me by my father, Zatzal. I have his version of the Sefer. The pages are well-worn, brown with use and age and so on. I'd like to move a bit further to the end of Perek, the final Pasuk of Kaf Beis, and the opening pasuk of Kaf Gimel. Two pasukim back to back. The two pasukim are connected. Again, whoever divided the Chumash into chapters did not learn Chumash Sabi'im. They made their divisions wherever they felt. But let us see these pasukim. Perek Kaf, the end of Kaf Beis. And we'll see something quite special from the Meshech Chochma. But we need to get there. So let's see the two pasukim. Pasuk Lamed of Kaf Beis, V'anshei Kodesh to Yuli, you shall be holy people to me, U'basar basadeh trefa lo socheilu. Flesh that has been torn in the field don't eat, what we call trefa, La kelet teshlichono, so throw it to the dogs. And the next pasuk, lo sisa shema shav, do not bear false reports, which is taken as an injunction against, one of the injunctions against lashon hara. Okay, before we get to the fusion between these two psukim, the first pasuk itself, as the Ramban points out, I mean, this really is, firstly, it's unusual for Chumash Shemos to be talking about matters of kashrus. If you would ask anyone, where does the Torah deal with questions of kashrus? The answer is in Parsha Shmini. The kosher species, the non-kosher species, and so on, of animals and fish and fowl. It's all in Shmini. And then again in Re'eh. Yet here we have one pasuk which deals with matters of kashrus, treifa. And as we know, treifa, we colloquially use the term treifa for anything that you can't eat. But treifa specifically means an animal with a life-threatening defect. Even if it's a kosher species, it's still forbidden for eat because that's called treifa. And says Ramban, firstly, because Mishpatim in his vision is the, in his opinion, is the Sefer Habris, it contains within it a sampling of many different types of mitzvahs. The second half of Mishpatim has many different types of mitzvahs because it's the Sefer Habris, including one segment from the halachas of Kashrus, which is Treifa. And it will move on to so many other things, Shmittah and Shalosh Regalim and so on. But how does the pasuk begin? Va'anshei Kodesh Tiyuli. What does this tell you, says Ramban? There are those who say that the laws of Kashrus are there for issues of health and so on. And it's just basically about physical well-being. It is a mundane and temporal reason that is given for the what the Torah allows you to eat and what it doesn't allow you to eat. Says Ramban, that's not all there is to kashrus. Kashrus is essentially something else entirely. And here the Torah itself is telling you there's a spiritual deleterious effect for eating foods that the Torah forbids and spiritual benefit from eating yes kosher foods. It's not just about physical health. And that's why the Torah prefaces by saying, V'anshei Kodesh Tiyuli, be holy. And the next thing is, and don't eat treifa. That's about kedusha. It's not about health. Health is important, but that's not this. It has overtly been introduced in the realms of kedusha. And maybe that's why the halachas of kashrus effectively are really lodged in the Chumash Vayikra, which is the Chumash of kedusha. Because that's what kashrus is about, the Ramban asserts, thereby, of course, taking issue with others who would say that it's more primarily for health reasons, which is famously the reason that is given by the Ramban in the Mor Nevuchim. Okay. And moreover, the Netziv in the Hamikdavar says that is why the type of treifa, an animal can be treifa for many reasons. It's a very graphic and specific situation that's been given here. Torn up in the field, basa basoda treifa. That's the only way an animal can be treifa. It can be in a pen. It just has a life-threatening defect. But that's exactly the point, says the Netziv. If it has this defect, just by itself, there's room to say, well, that's an unhealthy animal, and maybe it's unhealthy to eat it. But what if it was torn in the field? It could have been completely robust and in its prime until it just met a larger animal who got to it. And therefore, if the isser of an animal that has these life-threatening defects is for health reasons, there would be room to say that if it was torn in the field, so then it should be kosher because there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, it met a vicious end, but until that point, it was healthy. And that's where the Torah says, no, even basodeh. Treifa is treifa. It's not about healthy, unhealthy. It's about kedusha. That's why the Torah specifically chose the example of basa basada treifa. Became a treifa in the field. But now we come to the pasuk that follows, lo sisa shema shav, which is about lashon hara, and the Gemara makes a moral statement here about the smichus, the juxtaposition of the parshas, namely, lo sisa shema shav, person speaks lashon hara, shouldn't speak lashon hara, and if he does, what should happen to them? La kelev tashlichono, so they should be thrown to the dogs. Ro'oi lahashlicho leklovim, says the Gemara in Maseches Pesachim in Daf Kuf Yud Ches. And that, of course, is you know, an exhortative statement, again with the ills of Lashon Hara, ra'oi lashlichu l'klavim, where it deserves to be thrown to the dogs. Again, it's not a psak halacha. The Beis Din will not do this, but it's just to emphasize the terrible nature of avodah zarah, of Lashon Hara. The Meshech Chochma adds an element here. The Gemara has connected the idea of throwing to the dogs in the end of the first pasuk with Lashon Hara at the beginning of the second pasuk. But what about, don't forget, don't lose sight, says Meshech Chochma, what was stated earlier in the first pasuk. What is thrown to the dogs? Treifa. You know what that tells you? It tells you that not only does a person who speaks Lashon Hara should be thrown to the dogs, he's like a treifa. And what does that mean? So Meshech Chochma says, you know, there are two types of animals that can never be brought as a korban. One we know is a balmum, right? The blemished animal can never be brought as a korban. Try and sanctify it, doesn't work as a korban. And the second, of course, is a treifa. The animal's treifa, leave aside mums. I mean, it's not even kosher. Also cannot be brought as a korban. So neither the balmum nor the treifa can be brought as a korban. And you can't be makdish them, but they're not the same. Because, says Meshech Chochma, when it comes to a balmum, the halacha states, and this is based on the Gemara Maseches Temura and Tesvav, Yodal and Tesvav, when it comes to a balmum, if you directly try and consecrate it as a korban, it doesn't work. But it can indirectly receive kedusha, even the kedusha of a korban. You couldn't bring it, you'd have to sell it and buy a korban with the proceeds, but it can indirectly receive the kedusha of a korban. And this can happen in one of three ways, says the Gemara. Number one, what if it's Meiser? We know there's a concept of Maaser Behema. 1/10 of every animal, or more, every 10th animal more correctly, is from the new flock is consecrated as a korban. And as we know, they come out, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. What if the 10th animal is meant to be arbitrary? If the 10th animal was a balmum, it has the kedusha of Maisa. Again, you can't bring it because it's a balmum. You have to sell it and bring a korban with the proceeds. But it attains the status of a korban if it's Maisa. That's number one. Number two, what if an animal had a child, meaning a female animal, then has a child, and the child is a balmum, but the female animal has the kedusha of a korban? The child will also, Vlad Korban, also has Kedushas Korban. So far we have Maaser, a Balmum can have Kedushas Korban, and Vlad Kodshim, the offspring of Kodshim. And the third is Temura. We know that Temura, you can transfer Kedusha from one animal to another. This should be instead of this. And the second one is called a Temura. You cannot directly consecrate a balmum as a korban. But if you transfer the kedusha onto it of a temura, it will have kedusha of a korban. These seem to be very rarefied halachas within the world of kodshim. But the truth is, says Meshech Chochma, our pasuk is telling us a lot more than that. These three indirect ways to receive kedusha, maaser, vlad, and temura, can only happen if the receiving animal is a balmum, blemished. But if it's treifa, nothing. It will not receive kedusha of a korban, not if it's maaser, not if it's the tenth, not if it's an offspring, not if it's a temura, nothing. And what does it mean? What does this mean for us? Says Meshech Chochma, there are two types of people, and they could be flawed. But the area of flaw will determine. And it could be that each one is barred from Kedusha, personally. But the area of the floor can determine whether they could yet receive Kedusha or benefit from Kedusha, enjoy the merit of Kedusha indirectly. It depends whether their fault is in the area of Ben Adam Lamakom or Ben Adam Lachaveiro. Ben Adam Lamakom, it's possible, a balmum is possible as a korban. But you can eat it. A normal person can eat it. So the blockage there is between shamayim and the animal, but not between people. People could partake of it. That reflects someone who has deficiencies bin Adam lamakam. He's a Baal Mum. He is a Baal Mum. And Kedusha is withheld from him. Could be. But even such a person, says Meshech Chochma, if he's a Baal Mum, he could still receive Kedusha. Enjoy the benefits of Kedusha. Not directly, indirectly. How? Through one of the three ways that we said. Maaser, Vlad, and Tmura. What does that mean? We know that a person sometimes may be lacking in terms of their own individual merits, but if they belong to a tzibur, they can benefit from zchus tzibur. You know what that's called? Says Meshech Chochma, that's called maaser. How is this the tenth? Because it's part of a group. It's numbered together with them. And it can indirectly receive kedusha, even though it's a balmum. A person may not have their own merits, but they can receive merits of their parents. Zuchus avos. It's also a way. You know what that's called? Vlad Kochim. That's the offspring of Kochim. They're not so holy. Their parents were. It can help them. Finally, a person can receive kedusha from in the merit of their teachers who taught them. Even if the student is not entirely up to scratch, but in the merit of their rabosav. And what is that called? Tamura. Because kedusha has been transferred from one to the other. The Rebbe communicates Torah, transfers Torah, transmits it. And therefore, says Meshech Chochma, if we understand that the world of Jewish experience and parshanut and halacha and machshava, it's all one. And a Baal Mum can receive Kedusha by all of these things. But not a Trefa. Because a Trefa is barred even from human consumption. There is blockage there, even in terms of people. That represents someone who is ruptured bin Adam l'chaveiro. And because there is such rupture bin Adam l'chaveiro, he cannot receive Kedusha even through the three areas of Maaser and Vlad and Tamura. And why? Because that's Kedusha that comes from other people. But he has no relationship with other people. Only destructive. And therefore, if he has disrupted his bonds with others, he can't get Kedusha from them. And that is why, if you put the whole pasuk together, the trefa is thrown to the dogs, and the Baal Lashon Hara is thrown to the dogs, because the Baal Lashon Hara is a trefa. And why is he a trefa? He's a trefa because he creates ruptures between people. And he himself has no relationships with people. And therefore, he's more like a trefa. Not only is he deficient in Kedusha personally, he blocks himself from receiving Kedusha through others. He has frustrated those conduits because he has undone them and destroyed them. So it's truly fascinating to see, once again, from Meshech Chochma, as we've seen on so many occasions. It starts with the Pasuk, it goes to the Gemara, it moves to the Halacha, it comes to Jewish thought, Jewish experience, back to the Pasuk. It's all one. Who would have thought that the sugya in Tmura on Daf Yudalit and Daf Tesvav with Maaser and Tmura and Vlad Kochim, it's about a person's ability to retain Kedusha, to attain Kedusha directly, indirectly, vis-a-vis the flaws of the Baal Mum and Trefa respectively, bin Adam Lamokim, bin Adam Lachaveiro, Hafle Vafele. These are the words of Meshech Chochma, and on that we'll close. Of course, we like to think that we shouldn't need help from others to develop as much as we can in these two areas, but certainly to be aware of all of these other possibilities as detected in the Chumash by the Meshech Chochma. We leave it over there for this evening. Shabbat Shavua Tov. Shulah B'Siras Tovus. Bekarot.